Well, before we get started in our lesson, let me do a couple of things quickly. The first is to make a plug for two books. This one, Far Above Rubies, The Life of Martin Lloyd-Jones's Wife. I had a volume at one point, one of you bought it, and I've never read it. In fact, it was just recently that I discovered it. But in fact, I think it's a rather recent invention, and that's why I'm not familiar with it. Of course, it's a very nice paperback book, has nice, beautiful pictures of Martin Lloyd-Jones's beloved wife. And it's not a very long book, but it has a lot of nice pictures. And I have two copies of them, so I think I have one out there. And that, of course, being just $10, you can hardly imagine a book like this. It's from a nice publisher, the Christian Focus people. It's a very expensive, nice little paperback that we have at a discounted price. And it naturally fits our subject, doesn't it? Because we're talking about marriage. We're talking about the duties of husbands, in particular, towards their wives. And so this here will just, I think, whet your appetite for those marital themes. But you need to get it quick, because there's only two copies. And it's possible that we could do one of those. What's that thing called when you, like, bid on it? Auction. Do I hear 12? And then I finally got this book back in. I got five copies. And you might be, you might not think that it's relevant to our topic, that is, of marriage, but it is. Because it's Calhoun's Sermons on Important Doctrines. And this especially fits husbands who are to instruct their wives. And what better book to use to instruct your wives than Calhoun's simple but wonderfully precise sermons on important themes. I think there's only eight sermons in it. It's a smaller book, nice hardback. From Northampton Press, they only put out a few books a year, and they are very selective in the ones that they reprint. But the sermons, I got a copy out there on the book rack. The sermons include topics such as Christ our surety, Christ our righteousness, union with Christ, justification, sanctification, and salvation from sin. Those are just titles of sermons. So they're just lengthier treatises or sermons on those topics. So how important is it to understand what justification is? How important is it to understand what sanctification is? Union with Christ and all the other topics. The incarnation of Christ is the first one. And I've quoted from Calhoun, you guys would know that, over the last 18 years, a number of times. Probably one of my top three, certainly in the top three. He may even come down into the one of two of my favorite authors. He's certainly in the running for the GOAT Award. And so he's very easy to read and very helpful. And again, those volumes are but $10. That's absolutely ridiculous. It's nearly just almost unrighteous of me to sell them so cheaply. But nevertheless, I'll do so because we're friends. And that's how much they cost. So we want to come then this morning to the topic of leadership. And I want to begin by asking this question. And I want you to think about it for 10 or 15 seconds, and then we can discuss it. I'm not going to try to belabor it. If there's not a lot of interaction, we'll move on. But I want you to think with me, what makes for a good leader? Now, you can, actually, when I was thinking about that question, I thought to myself, initially, to my shame, well, I'm not really a leader. I mean, I don't own a business. And then I began to think for a minute, you know what? Actually, I have a lot of experience at being a leader. What am I thinking? After I became a Christian, I ran the chapel services in both missions. I had organized four chapels a day, two in the men's, two in the women. I had to preach and teach the Bible for 2 hours in both facilities. I had to organize things. I had to govern things. I was a leader. And then I got married, raised 5 children. I was a leader in my home and am a leader in my home. And for the 18 years, I've been a minister of the New Covenant and a leader in the church. So I guess you could say I've been only a leader since I've been a Christian. And you might be thinking, well, I'm not a leader. I don't have a lot of experience at leadership. Well, if you're a man and you're married, then you too are a leader. So it's not so much, are we leaders? The question is, are we good leaders? And thus the question, what makes for a good leader? Now, I know you're thinking and you have all these wonderful answers, but let me just say something very quickly. One, don't look at your lesson, Tony, because I provide you, I provide you my answer here in the opening introduction or in the opening paragraph. But you know what? You can think about this in two ways. General revelation affords us or teaches us or instructs us what makes for a good leader. That is, you don't even have to be a Christian. You could be an executive in a business or whatever, whatever. You can be a manager of a Popeyes or an IHOP, two of my favorite restaurants, and not be a Christian. But nevertheless, know just from general revelation, the general principles embedded in the fabric of creation, you can know what makes for a good leader. And, of course, more than that, we can find in the Bible what makes for a good leader. And, frankly put, those two overlap. If you were to ask somebody who runs a company, they're going to tell you basically what makes for a good leader. And you're going to find in the Bible those basic principles. So it's not that the revelation from general revelation, special revelation are equal, nor is it that the first somehow informs the other. It's the other way around. Because even if you're not Christian, you're still made in God's image and you have his law in shadow form in your heart. And so you know basic biblical principles, even if you don't know their basic biblical principles. But you can for mostly find out what makes for a good leader in the Bible. And I'm not going to turn there, but you find them scattered throughout the Bible, right? The qualifications or characteristics of a good leader. But you especially find them in one passage. And that is 1 Timothy 3. Because remember in 1 Timothy 3, Paul gives the qualifications of an elder and a deacon. Excuse me. So you might say, but I'm not an elder. Well, here's the thing. The qualifications for an elder are basically just generic, mature Christian character. Furthermore, husbands slash fathers function as pastors of a sort in their home. The responsibilities of a husband slash father are very akin to a pastor. They are. And so if you go back to, in your mind, because you know the passage, 1 Timothy 3, where Paul lists out the qualifications of an elder, we can categorize them into two lists. Some we call, the majority of them we call graces, that's character. The others, gifts. And typically we reduce down the gifts that an elder has to have into two. And they are teaching and ruling. All right, so those are the gifts that God gives elders. But they're also gifts of sorts that every husband or every leader needs, and thus every husband. All right, so before I go further and read my list that I have there, let me ask you. Oh, one last thing I forgot to say, and that is we also find and most perfectly behold the qualifications or characteristics of a leader in Jesus. The perfect leader. In fact, these five things I'm going to suggest in a moment are perfectly found in him. All right. Let me see if anybody can guess those five or else come up with some of your own and or similar ones. Qualifications, characteristics of a good leader. Tony? What was that?
Selflessness.
Selflessness. Excellent. We're definitely going to see that in a moment. Another one? Connor?
I'm not sure how to boil it down into one word, but at creation, Adam was given a mandate to subdue the earth. So wouldn't there be something along those lines that, like a leader, and specifically a man as a leader, there's something to do with it's very natural and right for us to have some kind of like, not so.
Yeah. 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 It's tough to put that in a word, but you're definitely getting at the heart of it, Connor. Some ability to organize, some assertiveness, some orderliness, wisdom, all of those kind of bundled together. Exactly. I think you're right. You're getting at it. Neil?
Righteousness, fear of the Lord.
Good. Was there one last hand up over here somewhere? Josiah? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, excellent. Yeah, those are all tremendous tremendous answers. And they all basically, in different ways, reflect the ones that I came up with myself. Because if you notice in your lesson, you'll see that I've summarized the responsibility of husbands leading their wives into these five points. Notice, a leader leads, one, by example. Two, he manages his authority. And that kind of goes a little bit to what Connor was saying. And again, I have to kind of clarify that. But he manages his authority. And basically, we'll see what I mean by that. He actually leads. He's assertive. He's not a bully, but he's a man. Greg, or sorry, Dan. We're going to actually look at that very text. Good. And because it goes back to, he's speaking to elders. And it goes back to my earlier point that elders, pastors, in many ways reflect the responsibilities of husbands. Good. So those are the first two I have there. Notice, three, instructs, four, corrects, and five, assumes responsibility. And we're going to see that those are all perfectly found in Jesus. They're also found in the responsibilities of elders. And they're also found throughout the Bible in terms of what makes for a good leader. But aren't they also five good things that if a man owns his own business, if you worked in a corporate or some corporation or something like that, that you had leadership training? I've never been to that before. Been to Christian ones. But a secular one, I mean, you could take those five, couldn't you, Mike, and put them in a secular class setting and teach five basic leadership principles. And they're all from the Bible because we're all created in God's image and we have the law written in our hearts in some form, even as foolish, fallen creatures. All right, so, well, we have to move on then. Oh, notice we're going to only look at the first two and then the latter three next week. So the first one, a leader leads by example. And the second one, he manages his authority. Now, this quotation I start with from Matt, I found a little later on after I came up with those 5 points. And it largely summarized them all, loosely speaking. Husbands, God calls you to be your wife's leader. This means that you must be your wife's servant. Somebody mentioned that, didn't they? That you must spend much time with her. I think Josiah mentioned that. that you must give her useful, scriptural, practical instruction, that you must be a good example to her, and that you must make decisions. You have to make decisions and delegate responsibilities in your home. That's a good little definition. Kind of covers all of that we're going to see today and next week, God willing. All right, notice first, a leader leads by example. Scripture often ties together authority together with example. The text that Dan mentioned. Shepherd the flock of God, this is Peter to elders, which is among you, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. Being examples to the flock. This first point, we're going to spend more time on the second of the first two, but this first point really deserves a lesson on its own, doesn't it? You know, we read elsewhere, Jesus said, that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. Yet it shall not be so among you. But whoever desires to become great among you, shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. So you find humility, servitude, example. His authority, Hopkins says this, his authority over his wife is God's, who has entrusted him with it. And our Savior illustrates his own authority over the church by the authority of a husband over his wife. The right and most effectual way of keeping up this authority. Now, that's a Puritan Old English phrase. Keeping up this authority means maintaining it properly, implementing it properly in the home. That's what he means by keeping up this authority, is by prudence, gravity, by soberness and piety, and a serious, exemplary, and strict life. Gooch found proof that leaders lead by example from Paul's exhortation to Timothy. Let no man despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, conduct, love, faith, and purity. This implies, says Gooch, it was in Timothy's power to maintain or to keep up this honor and not allow it to be despised, and so it is in the husband's power. It's the obligation of the husband to maintain his authority in the home. And how is he to do that, first and foremostly? Keep telling his wife, woman, I'm in charge? No. He's to exemplify all the character traits that we spoke about before his wife and his children within the home. That's how he's to lead them, by example. He's to lead them by example. Listen again to Gooch. Question. How may a husband best maintain his authority? Answer. That direction which the apostle gives to Timothy to maintain his authority may first be applied for this purpose to a husband, but be an example to the believers in word, conduct, faith, love, faith, and purity. It is as if he had said, if you walk before them in a manner worthy of your place and calling, he's talking about Timothy. Timothy, this is how you're not to be despised. Your authority isn't to be despised. See how that phrase goes together? Timothy, don't let people despise your authority. See, Timothy has a way, that implies that there's a way Timothy can ensure they won't despise his authority. And again, how is it done? Not by him just repeating over and over again, you're supposed to submit to me and obey me. No, but you're supposed to be an example. I'm sorry, I got off the rails there. Let me back up to that sentence. If it is as if he had said, if you walk before them in a manner worthy of your place and calling and worthy of that honor and respect which is owed to it, showing forth the fruits of love, faith, and other similar graces, surely they will respect you. But if otherwise you conduct yourself shamefully and not fitting for a minister, you give them good reason to despise you. Even thus may husbands, now here's his application, even thus may husbands best maintain their authority by being an example in love, seriousness, piety, honesty, etc. The fruits of these and other similar graces showed forth by husbands before their wives and family must work a reverent and dutiful respect in their wives
and whole house towards them, for by this means they shall more clearly discern the image of God shine forth in their faces. And then more simply put, well, maybe not simply put, but similarly put, is Bolton, man is the woman's head. Christ is man's head. God is Christ's head. For procuring and preserving which, let the husband be manly, grave, worthy, not light. Some of these are a little older terms, but I think you get it. Vain, contemptible. Let him not be bitter, wayward, passionate. Let him not be base-minded, vicious, vainglorious. Dissoluteness and a disordered life in the man do much abate and diminish the wife's respectfulness and reverence unto him. He goes on, majesty, authority, venerableness in any superior is not anyways more lessened or sooner lost than by light behavior, personal worthlessness, or unworthy deportment in his place. Whereas true worth, goodness, grace, shining from within, do beget a more loving reverence and reverent love than all outward forms of pomp and state that any boisterous or big looks can possibly produce. So you can stick your chest out and beat it like a drum. I'm the man of this house. I run this place. You are to respect me. You are to honor me. You are to revere me. You are to obey me. Or you can exemplify before your wife those graces that ought to be in the elder and are perfectly in the elder's elder. And that will ordinarily beget in the woman a willingness to revere, honor, submit, and obey. Now, is it possible? Yeah, it's possible. But it takes a very wretched lady to not want to honor, love, submit to her husband when he's altogether lovable. And wives, you know that irrespective of if he does this or not, you still have to do those things. We've already established that. But nevertheless, this is one of the most obvious ways, and I think it's often overlooked. This is the most, I think, obvious way and probably the most effective way for husbands to keep up their authority or maintain their authority in the home. Walk worthy of your calling. Right? I think this is evident. I'm going to go on and basically say the same things here in the next page. This practically means the husband must exemplify a Christ-like love, humility, and piety towards or before his wife and home. This is how he leads. He says with Paul, imitate me just as I also imitate Christ. For example, let me get even more particular. If a husband and wife argue and sin against each other, the husband must be first to repent and seek forgiveness. Why? Because he's a leader. And he must serve as a leader in every way. A leader what? Leads. And in particular, by example. The same is true with regards to every area of his life. In this way, he speaks in the way he speaks about people, the way in which he attends the meetings of the church, the way in which he governs his tongue, shows compassion to the needy, and walks close to God. This is how he leads his wife. He doesn't speak ill of the elders. He's leading her. He doesn't gossip about the brethren. He's leading her. He attends the meetings willingly and gladly. He's leading her. He reads his Bible, memorizes verses, and loves to sing hymns in the home. He's leading her. And we can go on and on and on. See, it's really somewhat unfortunate, isn't it, that a lot of men think that the way in which they maintain authority in the home is by beating on their chest and somehow seeking to force their wives into submission. If you think that that doesn't happen, then, brethren, you've been living under a rock. Or perhaps you just happily live in a home where it's not found. But I assure you it does, and it happens in Christian homes. All right, notice I continue in quoting Hopkins. Where there is an excellent mixture of prudence and piety together, the one to be a guide and the other to be an example, there will make a man truly awful. These will make a man truly awful and revered. Now remember, awful is good in this context. And induce the wife and the whole family to esteem and imitate him. Now, this is the passage I was thinking about from Beakey's, more simply put, and the one following Wayne Mack, but it's going to say the same thing as Googe and Bolton said on the previous page. If the husband fails to carry himself as he should, he may lose his wife's respect, esteem, and willingness to submit herself to his leadership or headship. If he behaves as a fool, she will despise him and hold herself to be wiser and better than he. If he behaves as a monster, she will likewise despise him, and though she may cower in his presence, this slavish fear is not the submission required of her and beneficial to him. It is necessary to understand how a husband is to behave as head to maintain the authority entrusted to him. For only then will he enjoy a clear conscience before God in the exercise of it and the comfortable and beneficial submission of his wife unto him for the Lord's sake. And again, Mac, surely biblical leadership involves being an example for those who are being led. Surely the husband's leadership means that he must strive to be an example, a model, a pattern of godliness, holiness, compassion, dedication, and devotion to Christ. Certainly, because of his remaining sinfulness, no earthly husband will ever be a perfect example for his wife. But that is what he should strive for. And when he fails, he should be quick to confess to his God and to his wife that he has failed and ask for forgiveness. Even in failure, see, this is what I got this from Matt years ago, but I can always remember saying, when we're supposed to be, the fact that we're supposed to be examples before our wives and children doesn't mean we're to be perfect. It means we're to be sincere. And when we sin, we confess it. And when we do, we're being good examples. Right? This is what he says. Even in failure, the husband must be an example to his wife of how the believer should deal with sin. In failure, as well as at all the times, the Christian husband is to lead his wife by the power and authority of a good example. That's probably as straightforward as it can be put. All right, I think it's all straightforward. Oh, by the way, let me say, keep praying for me if you remember, because yesterday it was evident as I was eating my tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches with cheddar cheese and sourdough bread fried in butter that I was able to taste all that. I'm thinking, man, I've never had soup taste as good as this. What's going on here? And then it hit me when I went downstairs, because then I can smell the difference of the study from that room and that room, that I actually was tasting all the ingredients. Sourdough bread, sharp cheddar cheese, fried in too much butter. And then this morning when I was taking a shower, I smelled the zest. I'm like, man, this soap tastes or smells good. I didn't taste it. All right, any comments or questions about this first point? Leadership by way of example. Remember what Vody sometimes says. If you can't say amen, say ouch. Number two, and this is what takes us home. A leader manages his authority. And my point is simply boiled down into the next three words. Leaders, I can just omit the middle one. Leaders lead. That's the point here. Leaders lead. They are not passive or inactive. Robert Bolton derived these truths, or this truth, from the relationship the head has to the body. The head is the seat of understanding, wisdom, discretion, forecast, out of which consideration let the husband stir up, quicken, and enlarge his manly spirit to comprehend and rightly conceive all affairs, provisions, occasions, which may anyways procure and promote his wife's true contentment, honor, and happiness. This means the head is designed to lead the body and not the body the head. I think that's a good application. right, of that principle. The head is packaged to lead, is designed to lead, and not follow. A hesitant, wavering, and indecisive man is no leader, or he's not a good one. While he mustn't be hasty, he must be decisive. I mean, again, just go to your business. I mean, what if you have a manager at IHOP who's undecided? I mean, hey, we're out of pancake batter and syrup. What do we should do? I don't know. He needs to say, call so-and-so. Go down to that store and get it. You, start mixing this and do that and this and this. He has to be assertive, right? And you know what? I've raised four daughters. I have a wife. Women need direction. Now, there's probably exceptions, but nevertheless, most women need. I mean, how many times a week? Probably at least once or twice a week, at least several, half a dozen times a month, my wife says, what do I do? And in most cases, I say this. Sometimes I just randomly choose it. I mean, if there's no big difference, I say, do this. Oh, thank you. Because I've been struggling for the last half an hour knowing which one should I do. And I just say, I just make it sound like it's some deep, The first one. Thanks, sweetie. I was thinking the same thing. There we go. But if it's something more elaborate or serious, then I ponder it. And sometimes, as we're going to see in a minute, I give, my opinion. I don't care, sweetheart, really. There's no big difference. If it was me, I would do A. And she says, thank you, I'll do A. She needs that. Now, is that being sexist or unkind? Or no, it's being biblical. It's a fact. Women need leading. Men are made to lead. That's the facts. Rather than undecisive, hesitant leader, it's going to get you in trouble. I mean, what if you were in a war, in some battle, Dan, and there's bullets flying overhead? You need a man to lead you. You need somebody to be assertive. Wise, not how I put it, not hasty, but wise. You three, go around that tank over there. You this. Somebody has to step up and take control. I mean, the principle is true across the board in sports, right? The captain or the coach, he has to be a swimmer. Could we just say, well, you just go out there and do your best? Everybody's out there running around in circles. No, he tells them, you do this, you do that, and you do this. Now, notice on the next page, husbands manage their authority by directing, commanding, and praising. These are the three ways that husbands actually lead. Directing, commanding, and praising. One, directing. Husbands must oversee their home and give wise counsel and direction to each member, especially their wife. To lead by oversight doesn't mean he must do everything himself or make every decision. Again, Proverbs 31. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. Husbands trust their wives to complete those responsibilities entrusted to her. He doesn't do them for her. He gives her encouragement, counsel, and direction. He must not micromanage, Beakey said, trivial and inconsequential things, as if his own hand needs to be at the helm in every little matter in the home. Many matters should be and are best committed to the wife's care and charge. Husbands are called upon to lead their wives by making decisions and by delegating responsibility. To be the leader does not mean that he must bear all the responsibility and do all the work while his wife bears nothing and does nothing. It does mean that he will see to it that the work gets done and that everyone knows who does what. I personally have I just feel for a wife that has a husband that smothers her like that. Sweetie, I'm calling to know whether I can make blueberry pancakes as opposed to regular pancakes this morning. And if he's indecisive, let me think about it. I'll call you back. That'd be terrible, wouldn't it? Now she can call and say, would you prefer blueberry pancakes? And I would say, probably. But to overly regulate and dominate all of the affairs of the home, that's problematic. That's what we're going against here. Let me give you some quotations from Mac and then somebody else. Husbands are supposed to lead, and leading involves making decisions and delegating responsibility. Any organization where only two people are involved needs someone who is final authority, or chaos and confusion will resolve. That's, again, that's common knowledge, or you can derive that from general revelation, what I called last Sunday rational religion, or how'd I put it? Rational theology. 50-50 marriages are an impossibility. I mean, there's some truth to that, isn't it? 50-50. But I don't personally like that idea. I mean, I guess you just have to define what you mean. There is a sense in which it is, right? Or I actually asked my wife that. I said, what do you think of that statement, sweetie, 50-50? She said, no, it's 100-100. I guess that's probably a better answer. They do not work, he says. They cannot work. In marriages, someone has to be the final decision maker. That's the point here. Someone has to delegate responsibility, and God has ordained that this should be the husband. Indeed, the husband must make decisions and delegate responsibility as a servant of his wife. Her opinions, advice, desires, suggestions, requests, fears, and questions should be given serious consideration. The wife is to be the husband's helper. She is to be his chief advisor, resource person, and consultant. Again, it goes back to the imagery of an owner and a manager, or a manager and shift managers. The manager doesn't do everything the shift manager does. He oversees it, he delegates it, he encourages them to do it, but he lets them do it. And a good manager will find the most competent shift managers and give them a couple, $3 or $4 more an hour if he has sense, and leave them to do what they know they have to do. Right? And this is a quotation from Whatley. I like that name. Who's a Puritan whose works haven't been reprinted, unfortunately, so you can only get them through quotations. And Beakey quotes him in his book, Living in a Godly Marriage. He says, if he will be both husband and housewife and be dealing with brewing and baking and washing and the particularities of these and the like business, it will come to pass that his wife can be helpful in nothing because he engrosses all things into his own hand. Again, go back to the illustration. The manager isn't to be there making the pancake batter ordinarily. It's delegated right down. He's making sure that the shift supervisor is making sure that the employee is making the batter, but nevertheless, he isn't to make it. In these things, therefore, he should permit his wife to rule under him and give her leave to know more than himself, who has weightier matters, more nearly touching the welfare of his household, to exercise his knowledge in. The manager has to crunch the numbers and budget the money and organize the schedule and not worry about making sure there's enough water in the batter, in the pancake batter. And if in any of these matters he shall meet with any disorder, it were a part of wisdom in him to advise and counsel rather than to charge and command. Now, that's a perfect way to transition here in a moment down to number two there, commanding. But just let that sink down into your ears for a moment. It's the better part of wisdom in him to advise and counsel rather than to charge and command. It's always better to counsel than command. And again, that's a basic principle, isn't it, of just leadership. It works better ordinarily when you go down, hey, did you make the pancake batter yet? Well, I'm going to do the eggs first and then I'm going to get to that because I like it. Okay. Well, have you ever thought about maybe if you did it as opposed to saying, no, you have to do it this way? See, again, that's natural religion. We get that that's, quote, sanctified common sense. You don't have to have a theology class to know that. It's better, when possible, to counsel than command. Now, we don't have time. I'm going to skip over that paragraph there, but you can see Gooch give some counsels warnings against being too strict. All right. Again, let me just put a plug in for Gooch. $30 for three nice hardback books, volumes, brother, you can't beat that. Gooch is a master, by far the best. You really need to get it, frankly put, if you want to start a nice family library. And better yet, buy it and read it. And then reread it. And then reread it. Now, commanding. This is the more controversial of the three. On rare occasions, and perhaps more difficult to explain, a husband may have to command his wife. That is, expressly forbid her from an activity or command her to perform an activity. Providing these do not violate Scripture, she has to obey. We've already established that. Now, I'm going to qualify that, but don't misunderstand me. If the husband commands or forbids the wife to do something or not to do something, and it's not sinful, she has to obey. But the husband has to be much wiser than just that. And that's where I want to come to as we continue. Three cautions are necessary. Okay, these are the cautions. One, A, the commanding part of a husband's government should be rarely used. But, you know, I asked my wife this. Honey, how many times have I just flat out said, no, you can't do it? Or you have to do this? I can't think of one time. I'm sure I did. And the only examples she could give is when people are sick in the house and I make them go to church. And she says to me, I don't think he should go. He's got a fever of 106. I say, just bring him and don't tell anybody. No, I don't do that. If it's 106, he can stay. He can miss Sunday school if it's 106. But sometimes I do say, no, sweetie, she's going. And she'll say, okay. She might say, I don't agree with it, but I have to comply with it. So that's the only context that I can ever think of that I've just commanded my wife. Now, there might be others, but nevertheless. Be very seldom in laying any command upon your wife. I think this is Gooch, probably. No, this is Henry Scruter. Be very seldom in laying any command upon your wife. An intimation of what you would have done is enough between a husband and a wife. An intimation of what you would have done. Sweetie, I would have done this. That's counsel over command, right? Entreaties of a wife do not unbecome a husband, and usually they do more prevail than flat commands. Better to counsel, better to give counsel than command, right? That's what he's saying. Another warning. B, the commanding part of a husband's government should be gently used. If pastors are to correct their opponents with gentleness, then surely husbands are to govern their wives with whom they are one flesh with gentleness. And if we're commanded to be gentle with all men, then how much more ought husbands to be gentle with their wives? Again, Gooch. As the use of a husband's authority in commanding must be rare, so when there is occasion to use it, it must be tempered with such gentleness and moderation as a husband, according to Paul's example, though he has power to command that which is proper, yet for love's sake must rather appeal for it. Remember, that's how he did it in Philemon. I have the power to command you, but I'm going to not use that, and I'm going to counsel you or encourage you. Against this is the insolence of many who cannot speak to their wives but by commands. Their authority is like a swaggerer's sword, which cannot long rest in the sheath, but is drawn forth for every little reason. This frequent use of commands makes their commandments regarded as nothing. You know, you think about it, these old guys, I mean, nothing's new under the sun. All the problems that we have today, they had. The only difference is we have cable TV. It's the only difference. And AC in our cars. And a couple of other perks. It's all the same old, same old. And that's why it doesn't get dated. You know a book is good is if it doesn't get dated. And Gooch wrote this in the 17th century. All right? Now, my third one is the more probably the most difficult to explain of the warnings. The commanding part of a husband's government should be used with instruction. Whenever commanding or forbidding a wife, the husband must be cautious not to violate her conscience. A husband, when he sees her conscience troubled about his command, must relieve her conscience by refraining to press that which seems so burdensome to her. This means two things. Let me read the paragraph and then I'll kind of clean it up some. This means two things. First, everything commanded and or forbidden must be rooted in biblical precepts and principles. And so that means that you don't just say it because I told you to. I mean, that's not even probably good parenting. We can talk about that when we get to parenting. There might be an occasion for that. I think there probably would be an occasion for that. If you tried to explain it to your child and he continues to say, but I don't see it or I don't agree with it. Well, sorry you don't see it or agree with it, but you're going to have to do it. I guess it's possible to do that to your wife. I think that that would be very rare, if ever, the option. You should always try to explain from the Bible, its precepts and principles, why you're commanding her and or forbidding her. All right? I think that's the first point's easy. if you cannot give a biblical reason of your command prohibition, you would do well to examine your motives and rethink your position, someone said. That was Perillo, actually. Actually, that was Perillo in his appendix, in the second edition of his book, The Complete Husband, where he's paraphrasing who? Gooch. He has several appendices in his second edition where he admits in a footnote, hey, I found Gooch's Of Domestic Duties after I wrote the first volume, and he kills it, to put it in contemporary terms. And so he has two chapters where he just, because this is before Beeky and them modernized it in the three-volume set, where he slightly modernizes it. And so that's actually a quotation of, well, who would that be a quotation of? I mean, it's a quotation, it's really Gooch modernized by or via Perillo. So I didn't even put the name there. Second, in doubtful matters, that is, matters not expressly commanded or forbidden in Scripture. All right? So we're not talking about clear moral issues. These are what Gooch calls doubtful matters. In doubtful matters, he may leave the final choice with his wife. He says, the conscience is subject to God alone. If it's forced, it would be a fearful horror and the very hell in that party whose conscience is forced. Okay, so this is what I'm saying, and this is basically what he's saying. If it's a clear moral issue, explain it to her. If it's a clear moral issue, there's no controversy over it, then she ought to see it. If she doesn't, then you still have to implement it. If it's a clear moral issue. If it's a moral issue, I mean, everything's a moral issue in one sense, right? But it's not so clear in the Bible. Maybe like, can the kids play frisbee in the backyard on Sunday? Well, that's, in my opinion, not a black and white thing. And so he needs to win his wife's conscience. Okay, now I'm going to go to my opinion. Okay, this is my opinion. She needs to do her best to have her conscience won. And she needs to do her best to be able to say, sweetie, I don't see it fully. I may not even agree with it, honestly, but I'm going to comply with it. But if she persists, I think, again, my opinion, this is basically what Gooch does say, roughly speaking, then the husband ought to leave it to her conscience and say, well, then I'll leave it with you to decide. Far better to do that than to run rugged over her conscience. That's what he's saying. Because remember, our confession teaches that only God is Lord of the conscience. All right, and there's a lot of questions that could be raised there, but I don't mean to be honest. I think the overall principles are evident, right? That commanding should be rare, A. Always gentle, B. And with instruction, C. All right? Let's move on then to the final, because I definitely want to get there. And that is praising. Remember, these are the three ways he manages his home. He directs, commands, and praises. The love which a husband owes to his wife further requires that he wisely praise and reward what she has well done. That which the apostle says of the magistrate's authority may appropriately be applied to a husband's in relation to his wife. Do that which is good, and you shall have praise of the same. Furthermore, Proverbs 31:28 expressly describes husbands praising their faithful wives. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Fewer things encourage the wife and stir her up to go on and continue in doing well than evident signs and tokens of gratitude. Husbands discourage their wife by ingratitude. They pass by many good things ordinarily and usually every day done by their wife without any approval, praise, or reward. They are ready to criticize the least slip or neglect in them and in such terms as if they never did anything well, so that their wife may well complain, as it is in the proverb, "Often did I well, and that here I never. Once did I ill, and that I hear ever." Now that would be a good Proverbs to resurrect when we get to our parenting. Right? If you're constantly just pointing out the faults of your children and never praising them for virtue. But it's true for our wives. My wife has said it probably 37 times, to be rather precise. Do I please you? Do I please you? Sometimes she'll say it when she stands in front of me with, "Do I please you? Oh, you please me." She wants to hear it. And men, if you're only or even mostly criticizing your wife and rarely, if ever, praising them, shame on you. To put it as plain as I can. Repent. Take heed to the warnings of our dear friend, Mr. Gooch, who's long since gone to his reward. And may that proverb never have any, may there never be any warrant for that proverb to be echoed in your home. Let me end with Beaky. How else is she to know whether or not she pleases him if he never commends her or shows his appreciation for her? How else is she to know the good he seeks from her if he never marks it by his happy recognition? Therefore, the husband must make a point of praising her when she pleases him. Not only will this commendation be a blessing to his wife to see that she brings her husband the good which God intended for him, but it will encourage her all the more to do good to him. Brethren, everybody wins. It's a win-win situation. All right, well, that brings us then next week, God willing, to those latter three characteristics of good leadership: instruction, correction, and assuming responsibility. And then, as I said, we'll move into some broader principles of a healthy marriage, and then we'll come to children. And we're on pattern, I think, to be done before the year, which was my goal. And then we'll pick back up wherever we left off in our confession study.